Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast number 54. My name is Terry Frost and I've had some computer problems. Nothing unusual for me. Sally tends to think that I can wreck computers faster than anybody else she knows. But my laptop, which I normally use for recording the podcast, the connector between the power cord and the laptop itself seems to have gone incredibly bung. It's not recharging. I tried wiggling it around for a while and it just isn't doing the job. So now I'm working on the desktop computer in the other room and we're going to get on with the podcast really, really soon. That would be about now.
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society!
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Paleo Cinema Podcast is a three-weekly podcast that looks at cinema between 1895 and 1990. We look at cult films, science fiction, action movies, foreign language films, and anything else that might be interesting. The voicemail phone number is 206-666-4886. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The podcast website is paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. This podcast may contain adult content, so if you're under 18, don't let your parents catch you listening to it.
And I'm back. How are you people? Doing okay here apart from the major computer glitch with my computer and the need to look at other means of doing the podcast. I'll give you the sad story. You can sympathize and you can send me little comments saying how shitty it was. Basically, the computer went bung and then I decided I was going to try to record the podcast using my little mobile podcasting gear, the one I did around Christmas time last year at Newton Mass time. With the headset and the little Belkin Go Studio. And I put the headset on and the headset busted. Wonderful. Love that. Got to kind of work through the adversity on that sort of thing. So I immediately went up to the local computer place and picked up a Microsoft, what is this fucking thing called? A Microsoft Live Chat headset, which is, plugs into the USB port on the computer. And it does seem to be doing a good job. Let me know what you think. Life goes on. It's winter. It's the depths of winter here in Melbourne now. Last night we had a lunar eclipse, so I'm very in tune with the natural world. This is, of course, partly due to the fact that I ingest a lot of the natural world in the form of caffeine, natural, locally roasted coffee. But I should get on with talking about movies at some stage because, of course, this is a movie podcast, as you all know. So what have I been watching? Apart from the movies for the podcast, nothing of any real import. I did see an old favourite of mine, which is I watched as a child on TV, His Majesty O'Keefe starring Burt Lancaster and Andre Morel. Pretty interesting. It's a kind of South Sea adventure thing with a sea captain played by Burt Lancaster landing on the island of Yap and trying to get kofa from coconuts exported back to Hong Kong. It's got lots of things. It's got natives throwing spears and Chinese pirates and nasty imperialist German trading companies and all sorts of weird things like that. It was actually filmed on Fiji. It dates back to the mid-50s. It was filmed on Fiji. So there are a few Australian actors in it, like Guy Dolman, amongst others, who turn up as part of the fun. And I enjoyed it. It's kind of like one of those Saturday matinee movies from the 1950s. Bit of fun and well worth checking out. Before I go on, I'll give you the other big news. Australia now has a female Prime Minister, Julia Gillard. She also happens to be my local Member of Parliament. Her office is about 3 kilometres away from where I'm sitting now. And it's created quite a political buzz in the country. It really changes the landscape of politics to a large extent, having a female prime minister. Not that anybody in America would know that. I think you guys should look into this as a possibility, a female president. It does make things pretty different in kind of the same way having a black president has for you guys. It's one of those kind of game changers. We're still in the honeymoon period of that, which you guys have obviously passed now, and you've got a lot of troubles down in the Gulf of Mexico to prove it. But for us, it was interesting. It happened very, very suddenly. Because of the way our parliamentary system works, it's not the president, the prime minister that we vote for. It's actually the party in power, so that it is legal for a party who, if the incumbent prime minister isn't doing their job in such a way as the government is able to win the next election, then they can ditch the prime minister. It's only ever been done this one time to a first-term prime minister. It's been done to prime ministers in their second and third terms, but never in the first term. And so there's a lot of kerfuffle about that. But I know a lot of my women friends are incredibly happy about this because Julia Gillard is an incredibly competent politician and incredibly diplomatic politician. And she has a lot of charisma. She's able to deal with the idiocies of male politicians in a very interesting and useful way. So just a little side note there. I'm very happy about that result. I've got maybe two friends who aren't, but then they vote conservatively. And so it was a very interesting week in politics that I turned into a political wonk for almost a week there. So I'm looking to see what other movies that I watched. I didn't keep a list the way I did last time around, so I'm just going to check that out for us now. Oh yeah, I watched Crank 2 High Voltage again because it was on TV, and I thought, what the fuck, I might as well watch it as do anything else. And it does hold up to repeat viewings. I mean, Jeff Chelios is the man. He's the action hero for the teenage years of the 21st century, really. Jason Statham is very good in it, and very underrated action star. He can do comedy, he can do serious. I think he's got a future career as a fairly good character actor if he plays his cards right. I know not everybody is incredibly fond of him, but I find what he does interesting, and I just like the total lack of governor, of an ability to kind of step beyond uprightness into total silliness, and his willingness to go along with that. Dry humping an old lady to generate static electricity to keep his heart going, for instance, in Crank 2. Don't question it, just go with it. Basically the guy's got the chops to do pretty much what he likes in cinema, and I very much approve of that. In fact, him and Clive Owen have filmed a remake-ish sort of movie of one of the two movies I'm going to talk about this time around in Melbourne. They finished filming in about March or April. And it's the movie I'm talking about is The Killer Elite, the Stan Peckinpah movie from 1974-75. And they're doing a kind of remake based on an entirely different novel in Melbourne, because basically there are some wide streets and we've got the film chops there. Weather's not too fantastic, but it does seem to be a popular place for some people to make movies these days. And, of course, the state government offers a lot of support to filmmakers as long as they're not Australian ones. I also watched one of the rarer Sinatra films that really hasn't had a lot of publicity, and it's probably not one of his best films. It's a movie called Assault on a Queen, which is basically the premise is a bunch of ne'er-do-wells find a German sub sunk in the Gulf of Mexico, of all places, in fairly good condition, and decide that they're going to recondition it and use it to rob the Queen Mary as an act of piracy. And amongst the characters in there, I mean, there's a pretty good cast. There's Tony Franciosa and Verna Lisi, an Italian actress who is very spunky, is in it. Alf Gellin playing the German U-boat commander who helps them renovate it. Richard Conte's in it. Murray Matheson playing the captain of the Queen Mary. So there's some interesting actors in there. And it's kind of minor Sinatra, and the premise is a little bit fantastic. None of the characters is particularly likable, though. Sinatra does try to play up to being the kind of moral voice of the piece, which is not a role that I find fits him particularly well as an actor. But it became available to me. I hadn't seen it probably for 20 or 30 years, so I thought, yeah, give it a go. And it's entertaining without being particularly fantastic. It does have one saving grace, though, a fantastic jazz score by Duke Ellington, which gives it a kind of bouncier beat than the film might otherwise have had. I'm not sure if the score's really great for the kind of film that it is, but I found the score, when the rest of the film was kind of flagging a bit, I found the score to be kind of cool to listen to while just letting the movie get to the next action scene. I also rewatched Joe Dante's Matinee, the film kind of based on William Castle's career, starring John Goodman, Kathy Moriarty, Robert Picardo, and a few other people in there. Nice small film. It's definitely one for the film geeks there. And the scenes of the fake 1950s science fiction action film that Lawrence Woolsey character, the William Castle character that John Goodman plays, creates, a movie called Mant, basically a man combined with an ant, is a lot of fun. It's a film that it's kind of a cult favorite for a lot of people, and I definitely know that Rupert over at for GGTMC, Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, has interviewed Joe Dante. I haven't listened to that yet, but I look forward to hearing Joe Dante talk about Matinee with Rupert, who seems to be able to get access to some fantastic directors. He's already done Alan Arkush for The Gentleman's Guide, and now he's done Dante. So I recommend that you pop over there and download those podcasts and of course, all the other ones that the guys have done. Fantastic stuff. But I was inspired to watch Matinee, and I recommend that you do as well. Now, let me see if there's anything else that I have watched in the near past that's anywhere of interest. I did see The Wolfman, the 2010 Wolfman. We bought it on Blu-ray and watched that. And yeah, it's a pretty fun film. I'm not sure how, it's a bit hard to compare it to the Wolfman starring Lon Chaney Jr. They're, of course, thematically and plot-wise, they're the same, but I find the kind of disconnect between 1940s special effects technology and 1940s cinema storytelling and the way that this film was shown and the plot line of it, it's very hard to make the connection between the two. It's worth seeing. It's definitely worth seeing. Sir Anthony Hopkins is good in it. Benicio del Toro is very good. Emily Blunt seems to be making a career playing Victorian ladies with a little bit of fire in their bellies and a little bit of spunk. Worth checking out, and it does look gorgeous on Blu-ray, and there are some useful extras on there. I haven't listened to the commentary track, but the extra short bits that they put into it definitely make the Blu-ray worthwhile. So I'm not going to talk too much else about what I've been watching. I'll leave all of that aside, and I'll take a little break. And in a moment, I'll talk about the first of the two movies I'm going to talk about today, The Killer Elite, directed by Sam Peckinpah and starring James Caan and Robert Duvall.
Went riding out one dark and windy day. Upon a ridge he rested as he went along his way. When all at once a mighty herd of red-eyed cows he saw, a-plowing through the ragged skies and up the cloudy draw. Fear went through him they thundered through the sky, for he saw the riders coming hard, and he heard their mournful cry. Yippee-yay! Were blurred and shirts all soaked with sweat. They're riding hard to catch that herd, but they ain't caught them yet. 'Cause they've got to ride forever on that range up in the sky, on horses snorting fire.
That, of course, was our famous cowboy Christopher Lee's version of Ghost Riders in the Sky, which I found on a slightly dodgily acquired album of Christopher Lee singing. Just thought I'd throw that in there to throw you guys for a spin. So on to The Killer Elite. It's a 1975 film starring, as I said, James Caan, Robert Duvall, Arthur Hill, Burt Young, Bo Hopkins, and a bunch of other people. It's one of the lesser of Sam Peckinpah's movies. In fact, he only made three films after this one. And he was very much on the outer with the studios at the time that he made this. So they gave him this kind of action film to do. And both Peckinpah and some of his cast members weren't particularly in love with the material. But in spite of that, it's an interesting film, and I kind of like it. First saw it back in the day when it was on release, and I'll just go through a few reasons why I like it and talk about it, but do a little bit of audio from it if I can do that. I've got technological problems at the moment, but I'm going to do what I can. I'll do the synopsis first, which is from Wikipedia. This has got to be the most fucked up Wikipedia synopsis I've ever seen. I'll see if I can clean it up and give you some idea of what the movie's about. Mike Locken, played by James Caan, is one of the agents of a private mercenary organization called ComTeg, Communications Integrity Associates. We assume it's a kind of like a proto-Blackwater organization working with and for the CIA. His friend, George Hanson, played by Robert Duvall, has been bought out by an unknown rival group, and they assassinate the man that Locken and Hanson are supposed to be protecting, and then shoots Locken in the knee and elbow as part of the bargain. Crippled for life and with his career seemingly at an end, Locken undergoes a long rehabilitation and earns another assignment from his ComTeg contact man, Cap Collis, played by Arthur Hill. Requires him to protect an Asian client, Yuan Chung, and also gives him an opportunity to seek vengeance against Hanson, who is part of the team out to assassinate the client. Lockhart, now skilled in martial arts with the help of his cane, recruits a couple of former associates, Miller and Mack, played by Bo Hopkins and Burt Young, to help him. However, the deal turns out to be an elaborate setup, part of an internal power struggle involving Comtech director Collis and his superior, Wayborn, played by Gi Young. Won't go into the synopsis any more than that, but I'll kind of talk about why I like the film, because it is an interesting movie in spite of the fact that Peckinpah and co. really didn't like it that much.
Now, why up here?
I like it up here.
You like it? I guess that's good enough. Still dealing in original sin?
Waiting for a shipment. Brand new AK-47s, best combat rifle in the world. Got a buyer, but the gun's running late.
Well, I got something a little better than clay pigeons for you.
I heard they retired you.
Not yet.
I don't think your company will hire me. They got me tapped as a psycho.
Well, they just don't understand you, Miller. Now, you're not a psycho, you're the patron poet of the manic depressives.
I'll give you 500 a day.
How many days?
Don't know yet. Can't be too long. I don't think anybody can handle 3 days of what we got.
Well, I need a little vacation. Besides, you always did enchant me, Lockett.
Did I? Hell, we'll just pick out some furniture and get going.
Meet you at Max Garage, 1874 Fuller.
This one's basically a samurai movie set in modern times. There are ninjas involved in various bits and martial arts and samurai swords at various times. But the whole arc of the story, you know, like a mercenary, a ronin, is betrayed by one of his friends and crippled and comes back and finds his center and becomes a better person and goes out to seek vengeance. That's a samurai story. It's also been adapted as any number of westerns as well. But basically, this film is a samurai story. It's based on a novel by a guy called Robert Rostein, a French novelist, and who's written a whole bunch of different spy stories, some of which have been translated into English, but you may find the old paperbacks of Robert Rostein novels if you search secondhand bookshops and things like that. Somewhere in the library, and I haven't had time to go out and find it, I do have the novelization of The Killer Elite by Rostein, the original novel, and I will read it again at some stage when I get a chance. A lot of the dialogue for this film was ad-libbed by the actors, so there's a scene at the start of the film between Hansen and Locken where the friendship is being established, and that of course emphasizes the betrayal that occurs when Hansen betrays Locken, and there's not really a spoiler there because it's a main part of the character arc. But basically, the actors ad-lib in a silly way and give you a really strong sense that these people have known each other for a long time and that they are quite close. As I said before, Peckinpah was in a lot of trouble with the studios at the time. He couldn't get a job in Hollywood, but Mike Medavoy, the guy who at the time was running United Artists, he believed in Peckinpah's talents in spite of Peckinpah's trouble with booze and drugs. Booze is alcohol, isn't it? He gave him the job. It was an action film. It wasn't particularly anything that was going to change the world. And it came on the heels of one of Peckinpah's major triumphs. In fact, it's really odd that this is the film he made immediately after Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, which I have talked about when I was talking about Warren Oates in a previous podcast. It's kind of sad because I think Peckinpah did bring a lot to action cinema, and I don't think there's an action filmmaker or an action actor that working today that doesn't owe him a debt for the films that he did produce, particularly things like The Wild Bunch, of course. But I think one of the things that Peckinpah did bring to it, in spite of what people might see as his kind of lackadaisical attitude to the film is there's a great sense of location in this film. There are some scenes in Chinatown in San Francisco, which give you a good idea. I mean, the setting up of the shots and when there's an ambush by Hansen and his friends against the guys as they're picking up their the person they're supposed to protect is pretty good. And there's also the scene at the end, which is set on a whole bunch of mothballed victory ships from World War II, which sit in Suisun Bay near San Francisco. They're actually now problematic, those ships, because they're a toxic waste hazard. The anti-fouling paint on their hulls is causing quite a pollution problem in the area, and President Obama apparently has promised to clean up those ships and to get them all to the scrapyard and clean up the bay because of those ongoing environmental hazards on these ships. But that's just a side issue. We're seeing all the rows after rows of these enormous ships just sitting there doing nothing. It makes a great location, even though it has been said by a number of people that Peckinpah's style of action direction, where the slow-mo kind of thing doesn't work particularly well with martial arts films. But there is something that occurred to me just a moment ago. Peckinpah did say that he prepared for this film by watching Bruce Lee movies, and why not, indeed, because Bruce Lee movies are fantastic. And as I recall from Bruce Lee movies, slow motion is used not inconsiderably in the action scenes in Bruce Lee movies. Yes, you've got the fast action, you've got the slightly overcranked cameras at times for other people, but Bruce Lee, of course, was very fast. But slow-mo was a part of the repertoire of people making martial arts films in those days, which maybe some of the reviewers of this film forget. It's not inconsistent with what else was going on at the time and just before that. So, I'll talk a little bit about the actors. This is probably my favourite James Caan role. Yeah, some people like Freebie and the Bean, and some people like other films that he's done, but I kind of like his Mike Lockham, because during the phase, I mean, he gets shot in the elbow and in the knee by Hansen, and they're not unpainful wounds to take. And Caan does a really good job of essaying the recovery and the rehabilitation of the Mike Lockham character quite subtly and quite well. Yeah, there's a kind of cockiness to him, which he has at the just after the injuries occur, but it kind of deepens into a resolve and into a determination as he goes through that rehabilitation. Now he does the character does shack up with one of the nurses who helps him through his rehab, a girl called Amy, played by Kate Heflin, the daughter of the famous character actor Van Heflin, and I really like that. And I'll tell you why. Kate Heflin isn't a traditionally good-looking woman. She's kind of shortish, and she has a slightly pug face, and I'm not trying to diss her by saying that, but I'm saying that she's a regular-looking human being. Lockham character forms a relationship with her based not on appearances, but on the fact that she's there with him, and she can see him through it, and they build up a slightly more genuine relationship than you would expect for this kind of scenario in a movie even of the 1970s. So I really like that. I like that kind of effortless depth that comes with the casting of that particular character. Duvall's pretty good in the film, but he kind of doesn't really bring his best game to the movie. But some of the lesser roles are cast and are played pretty well. Bo Hopkins as Jerome Miller, the character who's basically the gun guy, is pretty cool. He's there wearing aviator shades and playing it very cool, and he has some nice bits of business with Mac, the wheelman, who played by Burt Young, who has a girlfriend who seems to have gone through some kind of a trauma. And there's little character touches in here which aren't really necessary for an action film, but which flesh out the world of the action film quite well. It's not overtly done, but it seems to be, I don't know whether it was scripted or whether it was improvised or what the origins of this kind of part of the film was concerned. But I do like it. I like the fact that each character has a background which is fleshed out, maybe Miller less so than some of the other characters. But there is kind of a sense of something beyond the screen, which kind of makes this film slightly more interesting than it really needed to be. Of course, Gig Young's in the film, and he was also in Peckinpah's Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, playing Wayborn, the guy who runs the spook factory, in a sense. And he unfortunately, of course, was an alcoholic, and that did impair his ability to act and ultimately, of course, to live. He did kill his wife and then suicide. So there was a murder-suicide involved in that, which is quite sad. But I kind of like him in here. I think, again, even when impaired by his demons, Gig Young was an interesting actor, and he kind of has a cynicism and a world-weariness, which may be part of the man himself, but really suits the role that he's playing in there. I'm less kind of in love with Arthur Hill's character, Cap Collis. I think Arthur Hill in any movie pretty much plays Arthur Hill. He played not a terribly dissimilar character in some ways in Harper, the Paul Newman movie. And, yeah, I mean, he's there and he's one of those kind of, you know, you get the guy and you get him to say the words and that kind of happens. And, there's another nice thing I should mention, James Caan. There's a precocious daughter to the Chinese man that they pick up as a part of the job that, where they're being set up by the Comtech people. And the precocious daughter of the Chinese guy basically tries to throw herself at Locken. And his reaction to that, I mean, he's in a relationship. He's kind of gone through shit. He's a deeper and kind of more real person than he was. And he kind of fobs her off in a fun way in the film. So, yeah, this is a movie that's been dismissed by a lot of people as just another action film. But if you sit back and look at it, there's even kind of second or third rate Peckinpah has a lot of things to talk about and a lot of interest to it that a lot of other films of the same vintage don't really have. Okay, I'm going to stop talking about that film now. We're going to take another break, and then we'll get into the second movie I'm talking about this time around, which is Hickey and Boggs, starring Robert Culp and Bill Cosby in some very unusual roles.
Allow a choice of now.
That was Astra Gilberto singing Who Needs Forever, which is actually the theme song from a John le Carré spy movie called The Deadly Affair from the mid-1960s that starred James Mason and Bibi Anderson. If you get a chance to see that film, it's quite interesting too. The character played by James Mason, it was supposed to be George Smiley, but the people who made the spy who came in from the cold had the rights to the George Smiley name, so they had to change the name of the character. Anyway, on to Hickey and Boggs. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb with this movie. It's a 1972 film directed by Robert Culp and starring Robert Culp and Bill Cosby. I'm going out on a limb. I'm going to say that this is one of the most underrated crime films of the early 1970s. And, of course, having said that, got to back it up with a bit of fact. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a synopsis on the film, and then I'll go into exactly why I think this movie is worthy of much more credit than it has been given in the past. There's not much to say about the plot. The film was written by Walter Hill, who we know as the director of a number of excellent action films in the past, including one of my favourite all-time action films, The Warriors, which maybe I'll touch base on at some stage in a future podcast. But the script, as I said, is by him, directed by Robert Culp. Basically, the plot's fairly simple. Culp and Cosby play Al Hickey and Frank Boggs, a couple of weary, hard-luck private eyes hired to find a missing girl. The search brings death to almost everyone around them, and leading to a violent and downbeat conclusion. This is from Wikipedia, of course, and maybe if someone paid me, I'd probably have a career in Wikipedia writing better synopses than they do for their movies. But anyway, basically, it's a very atypical kind of crime action film for a couple of reasons. First off, the plot and what's happening on the screen and the characters aren't spoon-fed to you. They're not pre-digested. They're not in easy chunks for the viewer to digest. You've actually got to look into this and see the subtleties and pick up on the hints and the clues, not only of the plot line, which is sometimes a bit hard to follow because there are a lot of small scenes here and they cross-cut between the different actions of different characters, which some people can find confusing. But I watched this film about a week ago and had no problem at all following the plot. Maybe because I've been following plots now for a very long time, but who knows. Anyway, basically, they're two ex-cop private eyes, very down in the luck. They sit in the bar at one stage and have a conversation on which of the bills they're going to pay for, the phone bill or the bill for their message service. And they decide they're going to pay the message service so they can call up and get their messages, whereas if they pay the phone bill and let the message service go, they might not be at home when the phone rings. So it's that kind of level of grittiness, and there's a lot of scenes of them hanging around in bars. Frank Boggs, the character Culp plays, is an interesting character. It's probably one of the most interesting ones that he's played in a movie. He's an alcoholic, he's an intellectual in some ways, and he's also a self-loathing homosexual. Now, I'm not giving too much away by saying that. You'll pick up the hints when you see the movie, but it is who he is. And Bill Cosby is alienated from his wife and his daughter and doesn't seem to be able to communicate with them beyond a certain level, so he's got his own problems. But I found Frank Boggs a much more interesting character, possibly because essentially Robert Culp was a much more interesting actor than Bill Cosby ever was. Bill Cosby went back to doing comedy, as we know, and was incredibly successful at that. But I think Culp is the emotional heart of this film in a lot of ways. not because he's the director, but because of his innate talents. And both as a director and as an actor, he was a very intelligent man. He'd wrote a lot about movies as well as being an actor. And it's a bit sad. His death happened not too long ago. He was hiking through a canyon in the hills near his home, where he had a massive heart attack and fell on his head. At first, people thought that it was the fall that killed him, but apparently he had a massive heart attack, and the fall was just incidental to his death. So, sad loss. I really enjoyed Robert Culp in a number of roles. In fact, the very first Paleo Cinema, I talked about the box set of I Spy Series 1 that I picked up at the time, so... there's been a whole group talking about Robert Culp because of in this podcast. It's very much of a time in the 1970s. There were black radicals and Chicano radicals involved in the plot of the film. There's a whole bunch of vintage TV commercials which were very much part of the scene in LA at the time. You can see the pollution on the skyline, the changes that society is going through, the cops and the bad guys are basically businessmen. One of the bad guys, in this is Michael Moriarty in an early role, and one of the cops is James Woods in one of his very early roles as well. But one of the things I do like about the film, apart from everything else I mentioned, is the fact that when they're pulled in by the cops, he and the boss cooperate with them. They don't have to play tough guy with them because they're not going to get the shit beaten out of them if they do, and they just can't stand one more bit of bad luck. So they tell them as much as they know, leaving out a little bit of information, of course. But in a sense, they cooperate with the cops. And even though they do kind of go through and look through an apartment of a murder victim, amongst other things, kind of doing their own investigation parallel with the police one.
We're working.
I'm glad to hear it.
I hate to bother you.
It's all right. This won't take a minute.
You see this girl?
What, is she put out?
She's business dummy.
Mary Jane Bauer.
Yeah.
Tell me about it.
Some little sweet lips by the name of Rice wants us to find her.
What for?
The romantic connection.
A switch hitting sweet lips.
Huh? Yeah. Well, don't make fun of the client. We got a $5 bill retainer.
You think money turns my head around?
And there's another scene in the LA Coliseum, which is good for another reason. Hickey and Boggs both carry these enormous 44 Magnum handguns. And there's a scene with gunplay in it. I'm not going to go too much into a spoiler territory, but there's a scene with gunplay in it. And the bit that I enjoyed most about this is it was played realistically in the sense that if you shoot a handgun across a football field at somebody at the other side of the football field, you're not going to hit them very often, particularly if they're running out of the exits to a waiting car. It's very hard to hit things at a great distance with a handgun. And they don't try to pretend otherwise in this film. They really kind of go with it. And there's some machine gun fire, and the machine gun fire is, when it hits the walls and the objects, it's realistic for machine gun fire of that particular kind of gun, that particular kind of caliber. And there's a scene where they're shooting, the film shot is through some wire fencing from one character to another, and the wire fencing is slowly being chewed apart by the gunfire. I kind of like that too. There's some thought gone into the way the action scenes in this film are done, and all credit to Culp for that. I don't know whether it was in the original script by Walter Hill or not, but this is an incredibly well thought out movie. It doesn't tell the story in a traditional way. That it's cross cuts between short scenes in various areas, and really doesn't make it easy for the audience. And again, it's a very downbeat film. There's a terrific action sequence on a beach right at the end of the film too, which is filmed very well. It's probably something that some modern action film director should look at, because there are a number of objects on the thing. There are cars and a plane and a helicopter involved. And that sense of geography, where things are in relationship to each other, is extremely well done in this film. And though it is very sad to see someone with a machine gun chewing up a Rolls Royce, the action's realistic all the way through this film. There's nothing phony or Hollywoody about any of it. And there are some scenes of personal scenes in the film, which are played with a subtlety and a lack of sensationalism, which I really did appreciate. It's one of those films that, if you're a movie buff and if you're an intelligent human being, you're going to get a lot more out of it than just the people who let films wash over them like a shower. Actively watching this film really is a rewarding thing. It's got a lot more to it than it needed to have for the kind of film it is. At the time, it wasn't very popular. It didn't make a lot of money. But I think the main reason for that is people saw that Robert Culp and Bill Cosby were in the film and were expecting a certain style of film, the kind of, you know, the dialogue between them, the kind of light touch that they brought to I Spy. And they didn't get that. They did get two of the best acting roles that each of those two men ever did. And they got a film which, even though it wears the clothes of a detective story, is more about society and the way society kind of drags people down and the corruption, the changes that America, particularly Los Angeles, were going through at the very early part of the 1970s. It's a very well shot film. The editing is controversial, I'll say that, but I think it works. And I saw this film first when I was quite young, and I did see it in the cinema, come to think. I think it might have been the Town Cinema just near Town Hall in Sydney. If anybody in Sydney who's listening to this remembers the old Town Cinema. And I remember at the time being kind of disappointed because it wasn't I Spy, but kind of liking the fact that I didn't even pick up that the Robert Culp character was gay at the time, because it is played subtly. It's not something that's overt, and it's not something that's jammed at you. It's done as it would be in real life. So Hickey and Boggs, I'm going to try to get some audio into this review of it with my technological glitches. If I can do that, fantastic. But if you haven't seen it, or you haven't seen it for a long time, like Killer Elite, it's a good companion piece to that, because they are films that have been dismissed by a lot of people in a lot of ways. But while I can acknowledge the fact they're imperfections, I really think that they have more to offer than a lot of films of the same vintage, which were a lot more touted and a lot more commended by film critics and by people who ostensibly know what they're talking about on this. So anyway, I'm going to take another break, and we have some voicemails to go through. I have two voicemails, going to play them, and both of them are choice. So another bit of music, and then we'll get into that. Thank you. That is the Bubba Dub Bossa Nova from the soundtrack of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Kind of like that one. It's very retro and my kind of music. So we did get some voicemails. Thank you very much for the people that sent the voicemails. The number to call if you want to leave a voicemail is at the start of the podcast, so you should have paid attention then. Just kidding. It's 206-666-4886. And here's the first voicemail from Richard in Wichita.
Hey, this is Richard from Wichita, and we'll try take two on this. I am on the road calling from my cell phone in northern Oklahoma. I am on my way from my home in Wichita, 3 hours south to, actually southeast, I guess, to a little town called Bartlesville, Oklahoma. It's about 45 minutes north of Tulsa. I make this journey the last weekend of June every year, with the exception of 3 years, since 1998. I do it for two reasons. One, I get a chance to visit my mom and dad, who have retired in Bartlesville. And I go to the Trek Expo, which is a big Star Trek science fiction convention in Tulsa. Typically, they have about 20 stars from Star Trek, as well as other science fiction shows and movies. Met a lot of great people over the years. William Shatner is a big star this year, and looking forward to some of the secondary stars like Dean Stockwell, and just watched him in the Dunwich Horror yesterday. Gary Lockwood and Cara Delevingne will be there with a special screening of 2001. So just a good, fun event. But most of all, I get to spend the day with my dad. My dad will be turning 79 years old this September, and he's still doing the old Star Trek convention. So I'm loving that. I know I don't have too many more years of that. So I'm really going to look forward to that. As I'm listening to your podcast on the road, I just wanted to call and say that I loved your discussion on Night Tide. I had an opportunity to see that a couple weeks back. I actually have that movie as part of a 100 horror classics box set. A company here in the States called Mill Creek Entertainment put out these cheap box sets with 50 or 100 movies, all public domain. I know there's probably better prints of Night Tide out there, but actually the print in this set was not bad at all. The fact that I paid $14 for 100 movies, you really can't beat that. It'll take me forever to watch them all if I even get them, you know, through them all. But Night Tide was one of the better ones in the set so far. So I loved your discussion on that. You know, Dennis Hopper, you're absolutely right. It's unfortunate that we're losing some of these kind of unique actors in Hollywood. A whole era of actors are nearing the age where we're going to start seeing them pass away, and I think that's just very unfortunate. Mad Dog Morgan is a movie that I have not seen, and it's actually at the top of my Netflix queue to watch streaming at home. So hope to be watching that sometime soon. If all goes well, when I return home on Sunday, I will be able to watch Shock Corridor. As I was setting my DVR today to record an Alfred Hitchcock movie I don't have, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I saw that Shock Corridor was going to be on Turner Classic Movies Saturday night. So I set the recorder to record Shock Corridor, and like I said, with any luck, I'll have that to watch on Sunday. I really enjoyed your discussion of that a few episodes back. So just writing down these movies as you're going through and you know, listing some movies that I haven't seen. Pinchgut definitely sounds like an interesting film. I love Aldo Ray, so I'm going to be looking to see if I can find that here in the States and through Netflix if possible. If not, I have to go through various other sources. I just want to leave you with that. I'm loving the show, as always. Great to hear some voicemails coming in from some of the listeners. Shout out to Brother D there, and I know that Vince over at the B-Movie Cast is listening as always. Sir, you're doing a fantastic job, and I have to second what Brother D said. I love the fact that you add some knowledge, actually a lot of knowledge, about these various movies. You definitely do your research, and it's always fun to hear people talk about movies, but it's, and you know, informative and a lot more fun if you're hearing them talk about movies and giving you a lot of background information that maybe you weren't aware of. So keep up the good work. I'm listening with each and every episode, and you can add listening to the podcast on a highway in northern Oklahoma to the list of places that people are listening. Sir, as always, take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for that, Richard. I always like people calling me from exotic places, though. To you guys, I suppose Oklahoma's not exotic. Yeah, hope you enjoyed the Star Trek convention as well. Dean Stockwell being there. Bugger Shatner. Well, I wouldn't enjoy that myself, but leaving Shatner aside, Dean Stockwell, for me, has a lot more kind of cult cred than Shatner ever will. But, I hope you and your father both enjoyed it, and always a bit of fun. I should mention, while we're talking about conventions, that I'm going to be doing a podcasting panel at the World Science Fiction Convention here in Melbourne in September. If anybody's going there, love to have a chat. I'm going to be there for the whole 5 days. Probably be doing some other movie-related programming. When the programming people tap me on the shoulder, always happy to do that. And I'll be doing that as well. $14 for 100 movies. Yeah, I've got a few of those kind of box sets there. I find I usually watch 5 or 10 of the films, and the rest of them I'll take a quick look at and go, no fucking way am I spending lifespan on that. But again, it's one of those things where you kind of play your bets. Regarding Night Tide 2, I should let people know, if you can't find it elsewhere, it is available at archive.org. It's in the public domain, so pick up a copy there if you can't find it anywhere else. Siege of Pinchgut you can get from Amazon UK. I picked it up for fairly cheap. I think with postage it worked out at about $21 Australian to get Siege of Pinchgut on DVD. I'd already had an illicit copy, but I like the film so much because it's set in my hometown. Not long after I was born, I did spend the money and get a DVD copy of it, and it is a beautiful print too. What else we got there? As for the feedback, I do try to add extra to what I'm talking about in the films. Don't always do as much research as I'd like to. Real life does interfere, but I'm glad that when I am able to do it, people are appreciative of it. It's for me, it makes it more interesting talking about the films, apart from the audience enjoying what I'm saying. I do like to kind of get behind the scenes a little bit and give context in social as much as anything else in historical. But thanks for that one. So I've got to move on. And the next one is a comment from Rupert, the lucky man who gets to interview some incredibly cool directors for Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just listened to the new episode and heard you talking about Rosebud, which is a Preminger film I've never heard of. When you said odd Preminger film, I thought immediately of Skidoo. And for whatever reason, that made me think of 99 and 44 over 100% Dead, the Frankenheimer film, which is sort of been talked about on a couple blogs I read lately, and just screened a midnight show at a local theater here in L.A. Just wondering, I feel like you've talked about that film at some point. I feel like you've mentioned it. And I'm not sure if you've covered it. If so, remind me that you have. But if you haven't, I'd be curious to hear if you ever cover it, if it's something that you think is an interesting film or not. I've heard comparisons to Prime Cut, which I think you're a fan of. Anyway, just curious if it would be something you might ever cover. Keep up the good work, sir. Okay, bye.
Thanks for that, Rupert. Skidoo. Skidoo is a trippy movie. Very very 60s. It's like an old fart looks at hippies. And it has Groucho Marx, I think, in his last role playing a character called God. It's got Jackie Gleason. It's got LSD galore. In fact, the first time I ever took LSD, and I'm going into my deep dark past here, I didn't do it very much, I did 3 or 4 times maybe. The first thing I thought of while I was popping the tab was Skidoo, of all things. My experience was nothing like Jackie Gleason's in Skidoo. I did not see any football players with their pants off or anything like that, but weird and wonderful film. As for 99 and 44 100% Dead, I watched it the other day. In fact, I really should talk about it in there. It's got some weird stuff. It's set in a kind of gangster alternate reality in a weird way. It's got Richard Harris, his wife Anne Turkel. She wasn't married to him at the time the film was made. Chuck Connors is in there with an artificial hand. And it's one of those films where you think, what the fuck were they thinking when they made this one? And Richard Harris has the weirdest fucking worst hairstyle in the universe in that film. I won't talk too much about it because I may hit it with a podcast at some stage. But yeah, it's a film unlike any other. I'll say that much for it. And I haven't watched it all the way through. I got kind of distracted by my real life happening. But I'm going to go back to it and then watch the rest of it. And yeah, it's definitely on the list. So, and now we're on to the last. Oh, before I do that, I will do the actual email I got before I do the voicemail, because I want to leave this particular voicemail for last because it's worth it. Now, Troy Date did quickly send me an email regarding it. Good job as usual on the night type episode, Terry. I'm going to have to see that film now. Thank you, Troy. As I said, archive.org. I think I sent you that it was on archive.org, but if not, you now know. And I'm on to the very last voicemail, which is Dr. Zom.
Hey, babe. This is Dr. Zom. And after hearing your comments last week on The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, Dr. Zom thought to himself, you know what? This is a cool cat, and I need to leave him a little feedback. Oh, yeah. Dr. Zom wanted to call and discuss a movie that he had recently seen on the Netflix Instant Watch, and the movie is called Jules and Jim. Now, I know that this movie is considered a classic. Criterion, if you will, Daddy-O. But it just didn't do it for Dr. Zom, and I can't express to you how much it disappointed. Far and away, I was very, very annoyed by the two totally, completely cuckold gentlemen who were in love with the manipulative pain in the ass chick. No cool cat is going to put up with a chick like that, baby. Not at all. And all I can say is, if Zom was there, he would have banged the chick, smacked the dudes, and kicked him in the ass, and kicked her ass to the curb. That's about all I have to say. I'd like to hear your ideas and your review of Jules and Jim, if you've seen it. If you haven't, Daddy-O, let me know if there's any movie that was considered a classic by, all the film buffs that you found to be insufferable, boring, or just plain goddamn shitty. Zom, oop!
What can I say, Zom? You're the man. That Sammy Davis Jr. was beautiful. I was cacking myself about that one, especially when you slipped into Nicolas Cage a little bit along the lines there. Beautiful. Thank you, man. Anytime you want to call up and throw movies at me, please do. That goes for everybody else as well. But as for Jules and Jim, I do have a copy of it, but I haven't got around to seeing it yet. I'm going to have to now because I just saw Jean Moreau in the Bride Wore Black Truffaut's film, which if you get a chance to see, man, definitely one. If you want cool chicks, the chick in that film really does rock. Movies that everybody else likes and thought were wonderful that I think were shit. Can't go past Star Wars, really. All the Star Wars films were basically, you know, McDonald's fast food bullshit when I was looking for a gourmet meal. Yeah, it's controversial. I saw them when I was in my late teens, maybe 20 or so, 1977, 20 I would have been. And yes, it was pretty, and yes, there were flashy things, and yes, they stole a whole bunch of shit out of 12 o'clock high for the dogfights and stuff, but overhyped and really, really not my kind of thing. I saw all the movies. I went to the cinema to see them, basically, because everyone I knew was going, and I went with them. But nah, George Lucas as a filmmaker kind of leaves me cold. Gone with the Wind's another one. I really can't stand Gone with the Wind. I mean, Scarlett O'Hara is such a whiny bitch that I really couldn't get into it. There are a lot of films of that vintage, as you guys know, that I love, but that one, nah, it's like a crazed chick flick and not my kind of cup of tea at all. I'm not that in love with The Wizard of Oz either. Maybe if I hadn't seen it as a kid, it wasn't on TV in Australia when I was a kid. I know Sally's a really big fan of Wizard of Oz, and I respect that for her. She's got the 5-disc box set now and all that kind of thing, and we've got a great big poster of Wizard of Oz on the wall, but didn't really work for me. Not sure why. Maybe because Dorothy, again, was a whiny bitch. But, I'll probably think of others later, and if I do, I'll mention them. But off the top of my head, those are the ones that really stick out for me that people loved and that I thought was ordinary to totally bullshit. Sound of Music being another one too, because, you know, nuns and singing children escaping Nazis by marching over hills singing. Yeah, doesn't really cut it for me either. Anyway, that's about it for this time around. Again, please thank you for listening, and please I'll give some feedback through the usual methods. I did wrestle with my technology this time. I've done that once before recently. I've really got to get my technological shit together. But this one was harder than it really should have been to put together. Next one's going to be easier because I'll have my spanking new laptop. Well, it's not for that purpose, but you know what I mean. Set up the way I want it to. It's got all the bells and whistles. It's got a 500 gig hard drive, so I can stick a lot of movies to watch on that. Again, thank you, everybody, for your support. You're all fantastic. I love the community feel of podcasting. I love the community feel among movie buffs in this thing. Keep up the good work, because this is an interactive thing. It's not just me talking into the internet. I love the fact that other people's voices are now able to appear on my podcast. And I encourage anybody, if you don't live in an area where you can access that phone number, drop me an MP3. Happy to have it. We'll play it. Again, enjoy your movie making. If you make movies, go ahead and enjoy it. Movie watching. I'm going to try to. One of the things I want to do, given the fact that we've now got an Australian Prime Minister who sits down to piss, I want to do some more movies with strong female characters in it. So I'm going to try to look at that as one of the things I want to do in the future. I've been on a lot of very kind of guy movies, which is not a bad thing, and I want to continue that. But I'm also going to look at doing some movies with strong female characters in them. So look forward to that, and take care of yourselves, and I'll talk to you again very soon. Bye.